This is Audible.
Redeemer of the Dead, an apocalyptic lit RPG, The System Apocalypse, Volume 2, written by Tao Wong, narrated by Nick Podell. Chapter 1.
This is a bad idea.
Ali, my 2-foot-tall spirit companion, floats next to me, staring at the cave entrance cut into the river canyon's side. I crouch, glacial water flowing past my armored legs, summer sun highlighting the emerald greens and clear blues of the river. Of course. What exactly in the last 4 months has been a good idea? Taunting a salamander? Hunting a drake? Clearing a monster lair? Ever since the dam system came into place, it's all been one bad idea after the next. It's just a question of how bad we want to make it. I check the readings from Saber, my personal assault vehicle, PAV. Normal humans, we'd just call it powered armor, or maybe a mecha. After all, a half hour ago it was a bike. I got it nearly at the start when the system, the overarching mechanism put into place by the Galactic Council, came into being. According to them, since mana had officially reached significant levels on Earth, the system could now be put in place. Along with the system and mana saturation came the destruction of all our electronics and the mutation of Earth's ecosystem and spawning of monsters from lore. Cue the apocalypse as civilization fell. In the end, what Ali and I are arguing about is the blue floating system window dominating my vision. Dungeon located. Warning. The current dungeon has not been categorized at this time due to system limitations. All XP rewards are doubled. Successful completion of the dungeon by a system-registered individual will generate increased rewards. You said it. These kinds of rewards can be good. I stare into the darkness and heft my armored right arm, where I recently integrated a projectile weapon. While I love my beam rifle, good old solid projectile weaponry has certain advantages, including the option of using multiple ammo types to suit the situation.
Still a bad idea, boyo. Could be a bunch of really high-level monsters in there,
Ali says as he spins around in agitation. Yeah, then we run. We still have a full charge on the QSM. The Quantum State Manipulator, or QSM, is one of the first toys I acquired when the system kicked into play 4 months ago, bringing an apocalypse to Earth and shutting down all our higher-end electronics. When activated, the QSM phases me into another dimension, which makes it incredibly useful for running away. It has drawbacks, including a long recharge time and a short use period, as well as allowing high energy states, read explosions, to pass through. But it's saved my life more times than I care to count.
Fine. Light her up,
Ali mutters, and I grin, pointing the barrel down the cave entrance. I cycle the ammunition in the barrel, then open fire, embedding 3 glowing light sources into the cave walls. I learned my lesson about going into a dark cave a month ago. Even if Saber and my helmet give me enhanced low-light vision, it's still a better idea to light things up. The cave entrance shows me nothing new, but better to be cautious. I launch one of my drones to check things out, sending it to the ceiling to scan for potential threats before I send it deeper and lock it in place a couple dozen meters ahead of me. Once that's done, I walk in while shrinking the feed enough that I can watch it and my surroundings at the same time. I keep an eye on the mini-map that my spirit and my skill greater detection updates, even as I do my best to stay hidden. I'm a pretty good sneak, if I do say so myself, though announcing myself with a bunch of lights probably takes away from the surprise factor. Can't win it all. The first cave I find has nothing more dangerous than some mutated fungus. Fungi? Whatever. It shoots out spores that are probably poisonous, but I'm in a fully sealed armored suit with an independent oxygen supply, so John 1, Dungeon 0. Sweat runs down my back as I walk farther in. Cold sweat that even the environmental controls in Saber can't fix. Fear courses through me, but along with it comes excitement. Yeah, I'm screwed up in the head. I was before this started, and now I'm probably even more twisted. I actually like this, risking my life, dancing along the knife's edge of danger. It wakes me up, thrills me in a way that nothing else ever has, and I'll admit, I take risks no one else would. That moment when everything tilts, when I could live or die, is when I finally feel truly alive. No more walls. No more compartmentalized and contained emotions. Just moments of perfect control amidst the chaos.
Crazy. Told you. Picking up two. Nope. Three,
Ollie mutters. A moment later, I feel them myself. Damn. Even now he's better than I am. Then again, if the spirit wasn't, I'd feel as though I wasn't getting my money's worth. Not that I pay him. Not exactly, at least. He's a perk I gained for being in the wrong place at the wrong time, and the system pays for his upkeep. If it didn't, I'd have slowed my mana regeneration down even further, and I've got enough skills that do that already. I send a slew of new commands to the drone, launching it toward a higher point in the ceiling to check out the new threats while I lay down more light orbs. I wonder what I'll find this time. The answer is ugly, ugly monsters. Quadrupedal creatures with faces like a mutated rat's, spiked bodies, and whip-like tails that drip with acid. The creatures are dark green with blotches of black across their bodies, providing them an effective camouflage in the darkness of the cave. Conograd, level 28, HP 480 of 480, status effects none. I watch them for a few minutes in my feed, the creatures not noticing the drone. They don't do much beyond strolling around in curious circles in the cave ahead of me, occasionally bumping into each other and play fighting. After I've watched them long enough, I sneak in and launch a single light orb into the cave. As they startle, twisting to stare at the orb, I take the opportunity to put a few rounds into them. I've staggered the rounds in the loading chamber, so I shoot high explosive, armor-piercing, and normal in order. Then I put a single round into each of my opponents. The high explosive projectile blows up the spines of the targeted Conograd. The armor piercing drills all the way through, and my normal round smashes into it but doesn't pierce the monster I targeted. Armor piercing it is. Even as I make the adjustments to my ammo lineup, the surviving Conograds are returning fire with their barbed spines. I duck behind a nearby outcropping, but the launched spines move so fast and cover such a wide area, I get caught by a few. They drill through the nearby walls, the outcropping, and my armor with ease, carrying their mana-imbued barbed poison into my body. I grunt at the notification that lets me know I've been poisoned. There is no pain, though, just a comforting numbness that slowly spreads. A light chime lets me know the gun is ready, and I twist around the corner of the outcropping to open fire, concentrating on slamming three bullets into one monster. Each bullet smashes through its body, splattering blood around it before I duck back behind the measly cover provided by the rock. Thankfully, after drilling through all the rock, the spines can't completely penetrate my armor.
Can't touch this,
Ali chants and literally dances as he floats in front of the Conograd attempting to kill him. He might be visible, but he's not corporeal, which means he's a very good distraction. Grinning in my helmet, I charge the distracted Conograd and slice down with the sword I conjure into my hand. My personal weapon might not look like much, but with my advanced class skills, I cut through the monster's head with ease, killing it. Level 28 monsters are a cakewalk for me. While my own level might be a measly 23 because I have an advanced class, my true level is about double that. About, since, as Ollie points out, the math gets fuzzy. Jumping directly to an advanced class without a basic class has given me a bunch of side benefits, including a higher resistance to most effects, like poison. Monsters dead, I scan for any further surprises before slowly sinking down. My body shudders slightly as it fights off the poison, heat washing over the numbness. I lick my lips, tasting the salt from my sweat while I wait for the effects to go away. It doesn't take long at all, then I'm standing, walking over to the bodies and putting the system-generated loot into my inventory before dropping the bodies into my altered space. The altered space skill creates a dimensional pocket I can store objects in, a nifty little class skill that lets me store more loot and corpses than most parties can as a whole. Right, that wasn't so bad. If that's all I'm facing, this should be simple.
Ali, this cave seems huge, I mutter, kicking the last victim off my blade.
I've been down here for a good hour, walking through caves and killing Conograds, and there is no way this canyon holds such an extensive cave system. It makes no physical sense. If I'm going to be walking around here for much longer, I better get started recharging my beam rifle since I've switched to using it as my primary ranged weapon.
Dungeon, Ollie answers.
That isn't an answer.
Yes, it is. The system designated this as a dungeon, so it's altered the physical space. It's now bigger on the inside.
Ali pauses, awaiting a reaction. When he gets none, he mutters,
Goddamn muggle.
I think I liked it better when you were watching reality TV, I grumble while walking the cave. Normally, my skill gives me more of a heads up about potential problems, but the increased mana density in this dungeon is screwing with my skill, reducing my ability to scan for threats to a bare 10 meters. Ali's got it better, but it still means we have to move carefully. The bat drops from the ceiling, and I sense it just a moment before it hits. I twist, spinning around and conjuring my sword as I cut the noxious bat in two. Not its real name, but after my first encounter and a quick briefing, I had to turn off my oxygen tank. They're extremely good at hiding, but they smell like the seven heavens, so much so that even through the environmental filtering, my best method of locating them is my sense of smell. Of course, considering how powerful the environmental filtering is supposed to be, the fact that I can even smell them makes no sense. Then again, it doesn't have to make sense if the system decides to break the rules. Again. I loot the noxious bat's corpse, but don't stick the body in my altered space, not wanting to contaminate my other goods. Then again, I'm not entirely sure the bat would contaminate things. I have a theory that the system breaks many of the rules of physics because it's trying to balance technology, magic, and skills. So if it gives a monster an environmental advantage, it wants that to mean something. Thus, the system breaks other rules to make it work. On the other hand, I can punch through walls without breaking the ground while I do so, so I'll take the occasional weirdness. Not that I have a choice. The system is the system. After another half hour of walking, I finally come to the end of the first floor. And I say floor since I find a straight chute going down, leading to what I can only assume is another level. Arse. How many floors do dungeons have? I frown. I'm confident, but if I'm looking at a dozen...
How long's the ether serpent's tail?
I point the gun down, firing another light orb, then call back my first drone so it can recharge while I send my second down. Hopefully it's only these two floors. I only have two drones, and their batteries take forever to recharge. Down, down, down we go. Wherever we go, that's where we kill. That doesn't work, does it? Fine, you put together a rhyme while fighting off spine monsters in packs. Here, I'll wait. Actually, no, I won't, because I'm fighting Conograds. Ducking low, I grab a Conograd and pick it up, power armor assisting the lift, and I use the creature to block the spines from its friends. I poke my rifle barrel around the twitching body, using the camera mounted on the barrel to target and fire. I hear a distressed beep. I send the rifle back into my inventory and throw my improvised shield, following it to the last of the still-living monsters, which I stab in the head. Monsters dead, I squat as my head swims, my body shuddering as it fights off the poison and gives me back full control of my body. Casting a minor heal helps a little, so I do it again. The second level is taking forever. The Conograd's moving in larger packs down here, and they have a friend, a tripedal creature that skitters along the ground and releases beams of light that I have to dodge. Luckily, they aren't that common, but between dealing with increasing amounts of poison and greater swarms, I've been having to take longer and longer breaks between each encounter.
John, you sure you can do this? Ali asks again.
I nod firmly, slowly standing and rotating my shoulders and knees as I check how far I've recovered. I check my projectile ammunition next, noting I'm down to less than 24 armor-piercing bullets. I queue up high explosives next, but I never bought that many of them. I'm a bit of a cheapskate, and high explosive rounds are expensive. I kind of regret cheaping out now. Just another thing to lay at my father's door. Tackling these monsters head-on isn't going to work. I need to think of a new idea or pull back. I frown as another shudder crosses through me. I can't snipe the monsters. I don't have the line of sight. The monsters work in packs, so trying to drag them out to kill one by one doesn't seem to work. So...
This is degrading,
Ollie grouses. I chuckle, looking over the cavern I've altered. If I can't kill them one by one, I'll pull them into a kill zone and force them to fight me in smaller numbers. I've torn down some stalagmites and stalactites and piled them up to create a bottleneck by using some of the insta-cement grenades I carry these days. On the improvised wall, I've got a small perch that has a little extra padding to slow down spines, enough that I can shoot at the monsters in relative safety. I've also added light orbs as far as I can see to give me as much visibility as possible. After that, well, it's all up to Ali to play bait. Yeah, suck it up, Buttercup, I grin, leaning back and checking the map again. Asshole. Ali heads toward the nearest group on the map, fully visible and glowing ever so slightly. The kill zone works almost too well. Pulling monsters to a fixed position and firing on them as they near me ensures I take out one or two before the swarm arrives. After that, most initially try a long-ranged duel. When that fails, they charge the opening I've left. It's so tight that the monsters have to scramble and push to get through it, giving me more than enough time to whittle them down. The monsters are so blindly aggressive and stupid, they keep coming because they've got just that little chance to end me. After each group, Ollie gives me a few minutes to rest and loot before we start the process again. Each break takes longer as he searches farther and farther afield, drawing the monsters to me. The Kichik are the most difficult, since they actually understand a bit about cover and sniping at long range. Unfortunately for them, I can use magic, and I'm more than happy to spam my improved mana dart 2 at them till they fall over and die. I almost feel bad for the Conograd Alpha when Ali finally locates it. It comes rushing forward, flanked by its guards, and I greet them with a pair of plasma grenades, one after the other. The explosions rip apart most of my improvised walls, but between the grenades and my lightning strike spell, the guards are so much crispy meat. Facing the Alpha, who's just a bigger version of the Conograds, after that is simple. Outside of the numbness in my body that slows me down and makes me feel as though I'm running through water, killing it isn't difficult at all. I just have to keep ducking, cutting, and shooting the monster till it falls over. When I'm done, I finally get what I'm looking for. Congratulations! Dungeon cleared! Plus 5,000 XP. First clear bonus. Having cleared the dungeon for the first time, you have been rewarded an additional plus 5,000 XP, plus 1,000 credits. Bonus for being the first explorer, plus 5,000 XP, plus 5,000 credits. Ingalls Canyon Dungeon classified as level 20 plus and above. Damn, that was a good haul. That's a huge experience increase, especially at my level. Between the two bonuses, I'm nearly halfway to a new level. I loot the last body and drop it into my altered space. Pursing my lips, I consider the room around me. I always knew we'd be facing more and more dungeons. After all, we are designated a dungeon world by the Galactic Council and system. Having finally run one, I'm thinking these will be a real problem. Running something that's half my real level has me nearly out of ammo, tired, and just a little nauseated. Overall, I think it's time to call it a day and head home. Home is good. Chapter 2. Home is a two-story log house set at the turn-off on the Klondike Highway that leads to either Carcross or Teslin. A former restaurant and grocery store, the cutoff has clear fields of fire up to 50 meters around its gravel parking lot and system-cleared trees. In the past few weeks, I've paid to add reinforced system walls, windows, and doors to the building to increase its security, along with a simple command center that provides me with a system-enabled sentient tracking system and system-compatible utilities. The once-abandoned building is quite livable, if lonely. I had a house in Whitehorse proper. Okay, in Riverdale, but that's a 15-minute walk to downtown for a slow walker. I still have it, really, though I've not really been back for a bit. Being out here a good 30 minutes away by bike has been peaceful. When the system came, it destroyed anything with electronics or delicate mechanisms. Since then, mechanics in Whitehorse have been fixing up cars and trucks to make sure they're system-enabled, but it's still rare to see a vehicle on the road. Certainly no one is taking joyrides anymore.
I might return to Whitehorse proper one day, but for now, my ex-party is staying at my house, taking care of the upkeep and ensuring monsters don't move in. Whitehorse still hasn't reached the threshold required to become a safe zone, which would stabilize the mana flow around the city and stop monster evolution and spawning within the city limits. Last I heard, about 30% of the buildings in the city still need to be purchased. I can't even imagine the time it'd take to get a place like New York completely stabilized. As I pull up on Saber, I find myself groaning and stretching slightly. I can't help but think about the hot shower waiting for me inside the building. It's why I don't even see the giant armored hand that hauls me into the air before it's too late to stop it. Reflexes honed through hours of battle kick in immediately, and I'm jabbing forward, calling forth my sword. Before I can hit anything, my hand is locked to my side in an iron grip. I don't stand a chance of breaking out of it, so I don't even try, curling my body up around the arm holding me and kicking at the body with everything I've got. The impact is enough to rip me away from the arm, my body rolling and coming up by reflex, even as my brain finally catches up to wonder what the hell is happening.
Stop!
I freeze as my brain points out the many, many guns pointed at me. I'm surrounded by armored attackers, slowly shimmering into reality, cloaking, deactivating. All of them are large, tusked, and fully armored in black and green futuristic combat armor. Hakarta Lieutenant, level 31, Burning Scar. HP, 4,890 of 4,890. Status effects, none.
Gremlins, balls! It's a full elite platoon, John. This isn't even the right lineup.
Ollie almost screams as he pulls up the information, displaying data above each of my attackers. Lieutenant, a pair of sergeants, four privates and a major. The lowest levels come from the privates and their level 17 advanced classes. I've never heard Ollie sound panicked before, not even when I was taunting and kiting a salamander across kilometers of forested terrain. His fear opens up a cold pit of dread in my stomach, one that I forcibly compartmentalize. I'm so out-leveled, it's not funny. The cutoff is a system-designated fort, which means it has certain importance in terms of location and placement. When I first drove past it months ago, I was shot at by these guys, the Hakarta. Space mercenaries, most closely resembling our version of an orc, but with sci-fi armor, tactics, and laser weapons. Not to say they aren't armed with a series of nasty-looking melee weapons, either.
Are you the owner of this fort?
The major asks, making me turn slightly to look at him. I keep an eye on my original attacker, noticing how he's leaning forward, hands opening and closing. Trouble is going to come from there. The major's voice is low, a growl more than a phrase, but it's tinged with an upper-class British accent that reminds me of my popular Victorian TV shows. The idiosyncrasies of learning a language from the system can be particularly amusing, I've realized. I'd laugh, but I don't think they'd get the joke.
Yes, I reply, my hands twitching slightly as one of the Hakarta picks up the sword I dropped when I was blocked.
As a private grabs my pistol, I tense up slightly, then force myself to relax as the rifle barrels shift, following even that slightest of motions.
Arse. They don't bother touching Saber, probably realizing it won't work for them without significant hacking.
They do take my energy rifle from its holster on her, though.
What happened to my men?
The major says. As I hesitate, the lieutenant steps forward and throws a punch at me. I see it coming, in time perhaps to dodge it, but under their guns, I take the punch. It slams into my stomach, forcing me to bow slightly in pain and exhale. Of course I'm wearing an undersuit of armor, but the son of a bitch hits like Mike Tyson, or what I figure Tyson hits like.
Remove your helmet, and do not hesitate again,
the major says. I comply, removing the helmet to look around me.
Ali, Glitterball Special on my command, I think to him while answering the major. They're dead.
You are their killer?
The major asks. I can't for the life of me read him. It's not just the alien body language or the armor covering his body. It's that he isn't giving away anything. I consider very briefly and very quickly lying, but reject the idea. The Yarrick and Roxley both have ways of telling if someone is lying, and I'm willing to bet so does the Major. Yes, they attacked me first,
I answer, ready to let Ali know and trigger my QSM. The last time I fought these guys, they had quantum grenades that ripped through me even while I was in my phased state, but any chance is better than none. The Major looks at me for a time, then nods to the Lieutenant, who steps back, away from me.
Explain the incident to me. In detail.
I cough, rubbing at my stomach. As the Lieutenant moves to hit me again, I start explaining, in detail, how I was looking for survivors after the system came into place, how I was attacked while driving here, my tactics, and finally, how I finished the matter. When I'm done, the silence lingers for a time. The Major makes his helmet disappear, an act that is copied by all his men.
They hid in the command room.
I nod, fear slowly replaced with burning anger. I flex my hand, letting my gaze wander once more as I try to think of a survivable way of fighting back. I come up with nothing, even as the Major's face twists and he spits on the ground. A few moments later, the other Hakarta follow his example. Interesting fact, Hakarta spit is green.
I am Labashi Ruka, Major of the 63rd Division. It is a pleasure to meet you, warrior.
Labashi says, deadpan. The Lieutenant twitches again, his purple eyes narrowing in displeasure. I stare at the Lieutenant for a moment before turning to Labashi. First they attack me, then they beat me, then they introduce themselves? Well, I guess orc manners are just a little different. Or insane, if you will. So, fine. Insane it is. John Lee. This means you decided not to kill me?
Haven't decided yet.
The Major answers.
Your actions have cost the 63rd Division a decent supplementary bonus.
I feel my grin widening as he so casually mentions my death. Well, okay then. I keep my voice level as I buy time to figure a way out. Supplementary bonus?
Information about the city of Whitehorse was requested. As the information was not part of the original contract, the bonus is supplementary. It was, however, substantial.
Labashi just stands there, staring at me. Right. I stare at him, then flick my glance to Ali. Is he hinting I should give him that information?
Yes!
Ali bounces up and down, nodding.
If you don't, I will!
Well, perhaps I can help with that. My smile widens, becoming all teeth. All right, let's see how this dance goes. What do you need to know? Labashi returns my smile, all toothy grin, then flicks his gaze over to the Lieutenant. The Lieutenant makes a slight motion and a blue screen appears in front of me, detailing the information they wish. Current owner, political situation, individuals in power, notable parties, defenses. I shake my head, looking the list over. I know some of this, but I've not really been plugged in for the last few weeks.
Plugged in?
Labashi snorts slightly, large green nose flaring around his tusks. Been in touch. I moved out here a few weeks ago and haven't been talking to people as much, I explain. Labashi nods.
That is acceptable. Tell us what you know.
Right, well, let's see. Lord Roxley is a current landowner. There's a human city council that sort of, but not really, works with him about running the city. Some Yerrick arrived a few months ago and moved in too. No one truly notable beyond Lord Roxley and the Yerrick First Fist. Everyone else is low level compared to you guys. The city still doesn't have a stable mana flow, so safe zones are limited to buildings. The human population is just above 4,000, if I recall correctly, down from a population of nearly 30,000 before the apocalypse. As Labashi nods, I continue to speak, digging through my brain for the information he wants. I give him a list of facts, things he could purchase off the system if he really gave a damn to. None of this is secret, so none of it would be expensive. Hell, with their stealth capabilities, it'd only take them a few days at most to figure this out. Security includes gate guards, a stone wall, and I believe technological shielding on the walls, though I've not seen them in play. Guards are, of course, Lord Roxley's men and some humans.
Good. Tell me of these Lord Roxley's men,
Labashi says. I grimace, but settle in, detailing who I recall seeing. The only thing I leave out are levels. No reason for him to know that I can read them, and I'm not offering that information up. For what seems like hours, the questioning continues. Once they realize I'm willing to talk, the guards relax slightly and we end up on my porch, drinking and snacking. I introduce the Major to chocolate, which he seems highly appreciative of. He in turn introduces me to a fruit drink from his homeworld. It's a friendly interrogation, but it's an interrogation nonetheless, and he pulls a ton of information from me. I let him lead the questioning, never offering more information than what he asks for, but he's good, very good, at getting what he wants. All the while, the lieutenant stands directly behind me, and if looks could kill, I'd be a laser-riddled corpse. The flow of information isn't just one way, though. Being able to talk to them in a more relaxed setting means I can ask questions, too. Carefully. I learn why it took them so long to come check on the fort. It seems their employer is a bit of a cheapskate, and since each confirmed death of a Hakarta has a blood price, so long as the Hakarta were marked as missing, he didn't need to make final payment. This little journey is actually off the books and completely on Labashi's time.
I do like these Belgian chocolates best.
Labashi pops one last piece into his mouth before he stands.
However, I must return to my division. Would you prefer the blade or the beam?
I stand too, offering my hand once again. When my brain catches up, I freeze, staring at the hulking brute before me. Shit.
John?
Labashi asks again, his voice calm. In my peripheral vision, I see the lieutenant has already drawn his blade. I shake my head, then slowly speak. Why?
Blood must be paid in blood,
Labashi answers, and I gulp.
Bullshit!
Ali pops into existence, glaring at him. He's been quiet, invisible the whole time, and working furiously on his own screens while we talked.
Ah, the spirit makes his appearance.
Labashi's lips pull apart, widening into what could charitably be called a grin.
And why would I shit with a bull?
Bugger that! You're just angling for something with Boyo here. Why don't you just say it?
Ali taps his foot.
You boys aren't that bloodthirsty, and the fight was fair, so there's no blood debt.
Labashi continues to grin, staring at Ali before he laughs, then nods.
Very well, spirit. I shall stop pulling the leg of the adventurer. We stand to gain additional credits for continued information about this white horse. I desire John to provide that information.
I grunt. Now that my heart isn't thundering, that makes a lot of sense. In fact, from the way he was speaking during our interrogation, I was pretty sure he was going to ask me to do that, though I didn't expect him to threaten me. Then again, I guess this is what they call blackmail. That word, that thought, sets off the slow kindling flame of anger in me again, the one that's been trying to get out since I got attacked in my own home. I really, really don't like getting pushed around. Can do. Labashi grins again, clapping me on the shoulder and gesturing for his people to get together.
We will provide you a list of what is required.
I nod and wait till they're gathered and have walked away a bit before I call out. So what am I getting paid? They turn as a group, and even Ali spins to stare at me. Labashi opens his mouth and I continue.
Don't bother with threats. If you kill me, you get nothing. So that doesn't work out for you?
Of course, I'd be dead, but it still doesn't help you. The lieutenant shifts, stepping toward me, and I shake my head. Last warning, don't try it.
Gairak,
Labashi says, and the lieutenant steps back. Good discipline.
Do you believe you can beat us?
No, but I'm really good at running. I just need a little head start. I smile slightly, gesturing to where they are, and let just a little of my anger reach my eyes. That's about enough?
I see. And what do you desire?
Labashi answers, sharp teeth beginning to show as he looks at me. Payment, of course. You want me to be a spy? Well, spies get paid. I shrug. We'll call it, 20% of the system price? And to guarantee we don't ever have this conversation again.
Impossible. 20% is too high.
I glance at Ali, who doesn't make a move. What's your number?
10%.
25.
That is not how you negotiate.
Labashi replies, eyes narrowing. It is when you give a too low number to begin with. This is stupid, but that's okay. I'm about 50% sure I can get away before they can kill me. And if not, well, fuck it. I was dead as of 3 months ago anyway.
Shall we try for higher?
25.
Labashi answers, nodding. And a guarantee of immunity from prosecution from the Hakarta? I add.
I can only guarantee for my division,
Labashi says. That'll do?
Then the deal is done.
One thing. I don't guarantee I'll be able to get all the information you want, I add.
The deal will be voided if you do not treat fairly with us and attempt to learn the requested information,
Labashi adds, then his grin widens.
And I will find you and show you how we feel about deal-breakers.
Fair enough. I smile back at him, the pit of anger still burning away.
Then the deal is done,
Labashi repeats again. The way he says it makes me think it is ritual, so I repeat it myself. Contract initiated and agreed upon by Labashi Ruka and John Lee. Further details, yes or no? I blink and my eyes narrow slightly at the orc. He just flashes me another toothy grin before pulling on his helmet as the group turns and walks away. I watch them leave before I retrieve my weapons and dismiss my sword. I have a feeling I somehow got played. Well, that was fun. I slump down next to the door, letting out a long exhalation when I finally decide that they really are gone.
What the hell? Ollie mutters, shaking his head. You had to challenge him.
Didn't like being pushed around.
Idiot! And he got you into a contract. You sure you up to this, boyo?
Why not? Aren't you the one who's always saying everything has a price in the system? If they really wanted to know, they could just buy it. I might as well get paid, I say a bit bitterly. Anyway, I never said I wasn't going to tell the others about this.
Playing both sides?
Ali says, and I shrug. Possibly. This way, at least we know what they want to know. Better to control the flow of information than not. I rub my temples before I tilt my head toward Ali. I wonder who their employer is.
You could find out.
I consider it before I shake my head. I'm not that interested in wasting good credit. I look down at my hands, seeing that they've stopped shaking and somehow a chocolate piece is in one. I finish unwrapping it and pop it into my mouth, leaning back against the wall and savoring the taste. God, that was close. Could I have escaped? I wonder aloud.
No idea. Probably not,
Ollie adds, shaking his head.
You don't become a major without at least a few tricks up your sleeve.
Yeah, I shut my eyes, shaking my head. At least for now, the Hakarta are a known threat. I'll have to figure out what, if anything, to do about them later. So, care to explain contracts?
It's a skill.
Ali's brow furrows.
I guess it's not surprising mercenaries have it, but I should have warned you. I just didn't realize he had it. The skill binds the user and other parties into the deal they agreed upon. If you fail to live up to your side, it not only notifies him, but the system will also impose a penalty upon you. Mostly a mana tax and the ability for the user to track you, which can be transferred. Bounty hunters make most of their living off contract breakers.
I nod slowly, grimacing. Great. And the deal's open-ended. The only advantage is that, like any permanent alteration in the system, the Major's gotta be paying for the contract through his mana, so it's not something he'd want to keep forever.
All right, boyo, up and at them. You need a bath,
Ali says after I've been sitting there for a bit. I frown, then shake my head. No. Let's head in. I think I need some company. I slowly stand up and look back at the fort. Company, safety, perhaps a place to put my head down. The Hakarta aren't likely to come back, but tonight I'll sleep in my house in Whitehorse.
Chapter 3
John!
Zev chitters, hunched over and waving its claws in my face. I plaster on a smile for Zev, looking it over. With six legs and a pair of three-fingered hands on a black, hairy body with a bulbous abdomen in front, Zev looks like a giant black spider with hands. It's a little disconcerting, and the first time I saw it, I had to work really hard at not shooting it, and I'm not even scared of spiders. It's no wonder Zev mostly hides in its store.
Is Saber good?
Not bad, just some minor structural damage. I gesture at the bike as I turn it off in the parking space outside Zev's workshop. Zev chitters angrily, waving me away before it starts prodding its saber. As Zev scrambles around the bike, fitting a variety of wires into various slots, It pokes at one of the armor points and peels the point away with its tools, staring at the insides of the bike.
This is old. You should bring it in faster next time. Even if your nanite upgrades fix the armor, the structural damage is still there.
Sorry, I say automatically. Really, the structural damage was so minor it didn't seem to matter. Putting all that money into the Omnitron Class 2 nanite armor upgrade has saved me a ton in repairs, even if the armor class didn't go up. As Zev mutters to itself, I have to clear my throat to get its attention. After a quick discussion, I leave Saber with it for the evening and head for the butchering yard. The butchering yard is what used to be the old fire hall, a single-story sprawling building with wide barn doors that face onto the old prospector train tracks. The train tracks aren't connected to anything anymore, and before the apocalypse, they were mostly used to gouge tourists during the summer. The entire area from the fire hall to the old train station is part of the yard now, with the newly made compost piles making up the third portion of their rather smelly triangle next to the river. Thankfully, low-level enchantments keep the wind blowing into the river, keeping the smells of butchered and rotting carcasses away from downtown Whitehorse. Occasionally, a mage will come along and cast a purge disease spell to keep things sanitary, or as sanitary as anything can be around here. Of course, sending all those lovely smells out across the river brings its own problems. They've recently had to add guards on the other side of the river to deal with the increased monster presence. At the yard, I follow directions and watch as the bodies from my altered space are pulled apart, weighed, and portions of the body separated for both Sally, the town's leading alchemist, and Zev. As usual, I get a quest completion with a small amount of experience and credit bonus for turning in the meat, which is partly why I do so. The other reason is that while we're doing well with food for now, come winter, food will be significantly more difficult to acquire. Even now, the city is desperately attempting to stock up for winter, since we aren't getting deliveries from down south anymore. I wonder how they're doing down there. Shaking my head, I dismiss the thought. Not really my problem. I watch the men and women swarm the bodies, harvesting the body parts and dumping them into carts, moving with grace and strength that would have been impossible even a few months ago. As I turn away, my eye is drawn to the futuristic, towering monstrosity of an office building that sits smack dab in the center of the city, its mirrored, silvery appearance at odds with the quaint 2- and 3-story 1920s-era commercial buildings of the town. That tower is one I know well. It's where the shop is, and where Lord Roxley resides and reigns over us all. Once upon a time, I was a regular visitor there, till things fell apart. Once upon a time... I shake my head, dismissing the matter. As I walk up Main Street, I notice that more and more buildings are coming back to life. We have a grocery store with handmade local luxuries, an armorer with locally crafted low-level armor pieces, a couple of competing alchemists, a trio of clothing stores, the guild, the hotels that have been purchased, and of course, the only open pub in the city. As always, the pub is noisy and busy. What kind of adventurers would we be without a pub? It's not as if the Yukon led Canada in the highest alcohol consumption per person, or that our local brewing company was set up 2 weeks ago as one of the first major private enterprises. I feel my lips twist as I stare at it, wry humor and irritation sparking alongside one another in my mind. I don't even know why I'm angry. I shove it aside, bottling up the anger once again as I step into the establishment. The inside of the Nugget is all dark faux wood and worn, mismatched furniture. The apocalypse came on fast, and rampaging monsters and panicked humans destroyed the old furniture sets. Now it's catch as catch can. At 8 in the evening, the Nugget is busy and noisy, filled with people resting, eating, and drinking after a long day's work. Hunting parties sit together and dominate the room. A few craftsmen sit in their own groups. Skimpily dressed young women do most of the serving, dropping off beer, steaks, and fish and chips in large quantities. As I survey the inside, a waving hand catches my attention. Jason, a thin, weedy-looking teenager who looks way too young to be in here. For a moment, I consider not going over. However, Jason hasn't done anything to me, and I do want to check up on the kid. I walk over, letting my gaze slide over the group with him. Richard, red-headed and dashing, with a new young lady on his arm, and Shadow, a pony-sized husky, curled up beside his feet. Mikito, her ever-present Naginata resting against the wall behind her, a look of strained patience plastered on her face. Constable Mike Gadsby with his metal arm and tired eyes. The first two were my former party members. The last was one of the leaders of Carcross. Jason Cope, level 38 elementalist, HP 230 of 230. Constable Mike Gadsby, level 37 guardian, HP 940 of 940. Mikito Sato, level 32 samurai, HP 530 of 530. Richard Pearson, level 31 beast tamer, HP 250 of 250. I look around, spotting Rachel with the Brothers of the Wolf, the First Nation's exclusive group of teenagers, and my eyes narrow. Did she quit to join them, or... I shake my head as Jason pulls a chair to the table for me, squeezing it in so I can take a seat. My back is to the door, which makes me twitch slightly, but I'm the last to arrive, so beggars can't be choosers. Evening.
John, we wanted to ask Ollie about something,
Jason says immediately, not even bothering to greet me. A passing waitress drops a pint of beer on the table for me, assuming I'll be drinking. No need for questions of what I'll drink. It's either water or beer here, and I'm not drinking water.
Questions are 5 credits. Answers are 10,
Ali says as he floats after one of the waitresses.
Toots, I need a drink too.
I see the quick flash of irritation before the waitress's face smooths out. She returns to drop a glass from her tray before she heads back to the bar, where the bartender works feverishly to keep up with the non-stop flow of orders. You drink? I stare as Ali picks up the pint glass before chugging it down.
I do now,
Ali smirks, clearly proud of himself. Jason blinks at Ali before he shakes his head.
It's about stats, man. We've been talking about it, and I've been charting the growth. It just doesn't make sense. Like, I've got a strength of 20 now, so that should mean I'm, like, twice as strong as a normal human, or maybe double the peak? And I sure aren't. Even dumber? The non-physical ones don't even make sense. I'm smarter than before, but I'm not, you know, making physics breakthroughs. Richard's all kinds of sexy, and he's getting laid like crazy, but so's Mike. No offense, old man. But for the level of his stats, I should be wanting to sleep with Richard, and I ain't. No offense.
None taken. I don't do kids,
Richard replies, and the pixie-haired blonde next to him frowns, looking at Richard, then Jason.
So what the hell? I don't get this shit,
Jason says. Ali, I got this, I think to my friend. As the waitress comes up, I point at the chalkboard menu. One of everything. Having delayed it long enough, I turn to Jason and grin, a little cruel streak popping up. First, stop swearing. Your mom would be angry. Second, you sure you're old enough to be drinking here?
Har har, funny. I was talking to Ali.
Jason prods at his nose in an attempt to adjust non-existent glasses. I chuckle, leaning back, and pull a chocolate piece from my inventory. Seriously, though, I can answer this. It's very simple. It's the system. Richard groans, and Mikito snorts, sipping on her beer. The others just look puzzled at the inside joke. I elaborate. The system's the system. No use trying to figure it out. It doesn't make sense.
Oh, come on! I know you said this isn't a game, but we still need to understand.
I grimace, then glance at Ali, who sighs, putting his third pint down, half-finished. He lets out a large burp before he waggles his fingers, a glowing blue screen appearing. It's filled with symbols, circles, dashes, and dots that combine in distinct groupings, much like Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Right, System Basics 101. 100 credits, and I won't ever give this talk again.
100?
Jason sputters, glaring at Ali, who nods before Jason relents, sending over the payment.
Good man. You see that? That's what it actually says for strength. That's in system,
Ali points.
That gets translated to this.
The screen shifts, the language changing to a series of scrawls now,
which is Galactic script. That then gets translated to your respective human language. As you can guess, the translation is actually a lot more complex. When you increase your strength attribute, you are adjusting all of that. The change actually adjusts the way you manage mana via the system. For example, Gadsby, you should have shattered the table and your pint glass by being that rough. After all, you probably could punch through steel right now. However, your strength comes from the system, so the system alters the density and strength of things you interact with, thus non-breaking tables and ground that can handle movement at speed. Hell, Makito even bends beam weapons ever so slightly around her as she dodges. The system helps all of you without you consciously knowing it.
Jason opens his mouth, then shuts it while Gadsby and the blonde look on in interest. Richard and Makito look bored, having heard this before. Me? I just get to eating as the first plate arrives. Funny thing about adventuring, you end up eating a ton.
So your points aren't a straight line. They literally are a kind of approximate tool to let you understand the system better. The council cobbled it together from the way you guys understand the system and what it did bring about. As for intelligence and other intangibles, well, as I told John a long time ago, intelligence increases don't necessarily make you smarter. Physically, your brain has been altered a bit, but you can't do higher physics because you never learned the basics. You have faster neural processes, but if all you've done is fight, those new neural connections might help you think and react faster in a fight, but that's it. Also, don't forget that much of those increases and changes are going to help you control and manipulate mana itself.
Ali shrugs.
I've heard of a few people who have managed to become super geniuses from increasing their intelligence, but most of them were already on the borderline anyway.
Jason shakes his head, trying to put it together. What are you saying? That intelligence isn't intelligence? That it's more mana pool?
Yes. No. Maybe.
Ali answers.
Look, think of it like your Earth computers. You got a motherboard, your body. Intelligence increases help adjust the motherboard and the RAM, increasing both. Sometimes it upgrades your motherboard, sometimes it upgrades the RAM. Sometimes it adds a new graphics card or a new slot so you can plug in more things like psionic powers. However, you still need to run the right programs to make your computer work. That means getting the right skills. Doesn't matter how good a computer you have, if you're doing 1+1, it's still 1+1.
Jason frowns, then opens his mouth before shutting it. Kid's trying to game the system again, just like he did when he started. Still, the fact that he's filled out a bit and doesn't look like a stiff breeze will send him over probably means he's been putting points into something other than intelligence, which is good.
How about charisma? Am I sleeping with Richard because I want to, or because he wants me to, or because the system does?
The blonde queries, brow furrowed. I push my plate aside and tackle the next one. A plate of cross-hatched ribs stewed in a really tasty barbecue sauce. Even as I dig in, I make sure to listen to this answer. I know I have issues with that ability. It's part of why I turned down Roxley and Lana. I don't like the idea of being told to like someone.
Sort of?
Ali shrugs and opens his hand.
It's the same answer. Yes, his charisma trait makes him look better to you, makes his pheromones more powerful and enticing. No, it's not directly affecting your emotions or thoughts. You need to use a skill for that.
Left unsaid is the fact that a successful skill use would leave no traces when it came to social skills like that.
Maybe the system is affecting things to some degree. Then again, if Claudia Schiffer came along, I wouldn't say no.
The girl opens her mouth, then shuts it, looking at Richard, then back at Ali. Unconsciously, she edges away from Richard, putting space between them. Richard rolls his eyes at Ali, mouthing, "Thank you." He then leans back and folds his arms. Mike, on the other hand, is frowning, rubbing his chin. I guess the question of consent really bites, considering his former profession. Must be tough being one of two living constables and a couple of 100 kilometers. I push my other plate aside, grabbing the third and last one, a bowl of stew. Not much choice yet, but what there is good. As the others devolve into discussing details, forcing Ali to pull up descriptions and going into them line by line, I turn back to my own thoughts. One thing I don't add is that it's quite likely whoever created the system is purposely nerfing intelligence. I'd lay good money down that whoever built this didn't want a bunch of super intelligences running around. After all, if we got too smart, we might figure out a way to survive without the system, and that, I know, is something the creators don't want. I've called the entire system a scam, and the more I read and learn, the more certain I am that it is. It's like one of those multi-level marketing schemes where the moment you buy in, you have to keep buying in.
Coming tomorrow?
Makito says when she manages to catch my eye. I blink, raising an eyebrow, and she sighs.
The boss attacks?
I don't know what you're talking about, I say. She frowns, shooting a look at Richard, who has joined in the discussion.
That's why Jason and Mike are here. We're grouping up to take on some of the bosses. You should have been invited.
Concern tinges her voice. I'm not exactly Mr. Popular around here.
I don't care. Are you coming?
I shrug. No idea. I lean back as I push this stew aside, wiping my face before sipping on my drink. Maybe. You guys probably can handle it.
It'd be good for you. For us.
She sighs.
Fine, you bucka.
Yeah, well, I don't really see a point. I don't owe the city anything. Not anymore. And whatever she thinks, my presence might cause more problems than I fix. As she falls silent, shrinking back into her seat, I listen in on the conversation. It's moved on, thankfully, from the system to town gossip, and I make sure to pay attention. After all, you never know what I might learn, and I'm getting paid now. I think. Lana? I greet the red-headed stunner as I walk into my house. She's tucked away in the kitchen, waving at screens only she can see. Richard and Makito left the pub hours ago, both of them heading home to get some rest for their big day tomorrow. I have to admit, I was kind of glad to see them go. While I might not hold much animosity toward them, the camaraderie we had is now strained. By the time I decided to leave, I was getting more than a few dirty looks from the tired bar staff as they worked to clear up for the evening. Lana looks up, and Richard's sister, as always, takes my breath away. Piercing, bright blue eyes that turn green and violet in certain lights, and her version of a uniform, a simple blouse and pair of jeans, does nothing to hide her ample curves. There are people in this life who, if you're real lucky, you have the inexplicable it with. Call it chemistry, call it a biological urge, some even call it love, but there's an instantaneous attraction. As Lana smiles at me, I can't help but think it only took the end of the world for me to meet not one, but two such individuals at the same damn time. Of course, it would require the end of the world to meet a Trinar like Roxley. All in all, it's about par for the course with my luck. Flicking her hand to dismiss her system screens, she says,
John.
Up late, I step into the kitchen, drawn like a moth to a flame. Closer, I see slight bags under her eyes and a tension in her shoulders that I've never seen before. Just work. Her eyes flick over my form, too, in silent assessment.
What's wrong?
Isn't that my line?
Har. I'm not the one who runs into trouble all the time. I'm just a paper pusher,
she says, shaking her head.
Seriously, John. What's wrong?
Nothing much. I keep my hands on the table, mostly to make sure I know where they are as I sit down across her. I have to admit, it bothers me a little that she can read me so well. Even my father never seemed to be able to do that. Not that he ever paid that much attention to me. I push the old bitter thoughts aside.
John,
Lana's voice changes, growing stern. I just had some visitors. The Hakarta. I shrug, and at her puzzled expression, I add, the space orcs.
Oh.
Her lips tighten, then she shakes her head, drawing her own conclusions. Probably violent ones. So what papers are you pushing?
The usual? Business proposals? Loan extension requests? Reports and cash flow projections?
She shakes her head before rubbing her temples. Lana runs the biggest investment fund in Whitehorse, initially funded through my killings, but these days it's pretty self-sufficient. From what I recall, she basically has a hand in every significant private enterprise since the system came into play. Not that I've seen a credit in return. Every single credit of profit has been plowed right back into the city and the fund. Still, it's nice to know I've got a nest egg growing somewhere.
Get an AI, Toots,
Ali says, appearing on the table next to her and flashing her a grin.
Ali?
The smile Lana gives the spirit sends a spike of anger through me, and I quell it. Just because the two have gotten closer since they saved my ass a month ago is no reason for me to get jealous. None at all.
Aren't those expensive?
She asks.
Only if you get them as a companion. If you get an off-the-rack one, they'll be pretty cheap. A basic one shouldn't cost you much at all. Just make sure to get the heavy security models. Definitely don't get a spirit. No self-respecting spirit wants to be a glorified personal assistant.
Lana nods, rubbing her chin.
I don't know. I don't have a lot of credits left.
Use the fund, I chime in. It's a business expense.
I don't think it works that way,
Lana says, frowning at me. Says who? I smirk, then wave. Not as if the CRA are coming after you for taxes. So long as you buy through the shop, Roxley gets his cut. Way I see it, you're all good.
I guess.
She rubs her temples again before her voice drops lower.
John, we should talk.
Yes. I blink, tilting my head. I quell the urge to flee, sensible as it may be.